Well, as one who was deeply affected by Ayn Rand in my younger days, I think I traveled across the country in a Volkswagen with a copy of The Fountainhead.
Really?
And where I went, and still have that copy. I couldn't afford the hardcover books of Ayn Rand, but I bought the paperbacks, umpteenth edition of the paperbacks, and I still have them. I put cardboard, I guess they were professionally made cardboard covers that you glued to the paperback to keep them in place.
I wish I'd done that.
And I still have all of the paperbacks, and subsequently, because I was so profoundly influenced by Ayn Rand as a youth, I then began to look for the hardcover books, so I have hardcovers of most of the significant books. So she was important to me when I was young, and she's still important to me, and so I was very interested when the biography of Ayn Rand came out, and I learned things that I had no idea. For example, I never knew Ayn Rand was Jewish. Now, I don't know if she ever kept this a secret, but it just never occurred to me.
No, she never kept it a secret, but she was an atheist, so that religion, her religion, anybody's religion, was of no significance to her. If asked if it was relevant, she would say, "I was born Jewish." But it truly had no meaning to her.
How did she come about the name Ayn Rand?
In two ways. She did not like her original name, which was Alice Rosenbaum. And when she came to America, she felt she ought to change it anyhow, because the communists had taken power in Russia, and she knew she'd be writing anti-communist works, and she didn't want to endanger her family in Russia. She chose Ayn from... It was the name of a Finnish writer whom Ayn had never read, but she liked the name. When she got to America, she was trying to decide on a last name. And a cousin of hers, whom I spoke to, who was there at the time, told me, and I repeat it in The Passion of Ayn Rand, that Ayn was sitting in front of her typewriter, which was a Remington Rand, and thinking aloud, saying, "Ayn Remington? No. Ayn Rand, that's it." And that's where she got her name.
Well, tell me a little bit about Ayn Rand's origins. You say she was born in the Soviet Union. In what city?
It wasn't the Soviet Union then. She was born in what was then St. Petersburg in 1905. Her family was, I would say, moderately wealthy. Not very wealthy, but wealthy enough to lose everything with the revolution.
And she became embittered during her formative years against the state as it existed at that time.
With good reason, yes, she did indeed. They suffered terribly under the revolution. Of course, her father lost everything instantly. And they suffered hunger, terror, dreadful poverty, as did most people there at that time, especially the bourgeoisie.
She also developed, I guess, her first love. I don't know that this love was ever consummated, but it was with a young man by the name of Leo. Tell me about that.
That's
and
right.
It's that relationship's effect on her life.
It had a lot of effect on her life. She was at the University of Petrograd in... It was then Petrograd. And she had... She met a young man at a party who was to her in physical appearance, which was always very important to Ayn. Everything she thought what she would call the ideal man should be in physical appearance. She fell madly in love with him, almost at first sight, as she was to later do in America with the man she married and lived with for 50 years. The face meant everything to her. She believed that in his face she saw his character. This young man did not return her feeling, which was desperately painful for her, particularly under the circumstances of her life at that time. She felt that in Soviet Russia, under the communists, she had no life. There was nothing in external reality that brought her any pleasure. It was suffering and hunger and poverty. When this young man came along, she thought, "This will be something real in my life that can give me pleasure." But he did not return her feeling, and she was desperately unhappy about it.
Luckily for Ayn Rand, she had relatives in Chicago, and this enabled her to leave the Soviet Union. How old was she at that time?
She was 21. She left the Soviet Union with $50, which she considered a fortune, and a ticket which got her to New York. and then to Chicago, where her relatives lived.
Did she speak English?
She spoke a little English. It was pretty halting. She struggled very hard to improve it, and certainly did. But in the early years, she was really working on it. It was not good. Her accent was very heavy.
Her goal was to become a screenwriter, wasn't it?
Yes, but it was a means to an end. She had known from the age of 9 that she wanted to write novels. She was always very interested in the screen. It was not only a means to an end. It was a deep interest. But yes, she did want to be a screenwriter. She knew, however, at the time that her English wasn't good enough for her to write the total of a screenplay, even for silent movies. She could not write the subtitles. What she thought she would do and succeeded in doing was to write the story, and then someone whose English was better would write the subtitles. It didn't work for a while. Her English was better, but within less than a year, she was a junior screenwriter for DeMille.
Well, she went to Hollywood, and indeed she had a fortuitous meeting with DeMille. How did this come about?
It's a story she loved to tell, because it is so dramatic and so much out of her kind of fiction. She had gone to the DeMille studio to look for a job as a screenwriter. She had an introduction to someone who was in no position to help her, nor did it seem likely that she could possibly get a job. As she was leaving the studio, she saw DeMille sitting in a car. It was an open roadster, so she recognized him. And she simply stood and stared at him, fascinated. He'd been her favorite American director when she was still in Russia, and had seen American movies. He saw her staring, for some reason or other was intrigued, pulled up beside her, and said, "Get in." She later said if it had been a ship to the moon, she would have gotten in, as long as DeMille were in the car. He took her to the set. He asked her questions about herself. She answered them. He apparently was more intrigued by her story. He took her to the set of The King of Kings, which he was then making, and gave her a job as an extra.
Something else happened on that set.
Yes, indeed. It was there that she met the man, Frank O'Connor, whom she later married and who was her husband until his death 50 years later.
That was a very interesting relationship, because Frank O'Connor's career as an actor never took off.
No.
What sort of relationship did Ayn Rand have with Frank O'Connor, and what happened to Frank O'Connor to impede his progress as an individual? I don't know if that's an accurate assessment, but at least progress in terms of a career.
In my mind, it's a very sad story. I believe that Ayn truly loved Frank, but he was a gentle, kind, lovely man, whom I personally loved very dearly. He was not a hero out of Ayn Rand's fiction. He was not ambitious to the same extent nearly that her heroes were. He was not about to set the world on fire. Ayn, I believe, truly loved him, but could not accept that he was not a hero out of her novels, and in her own mind and in her conversations with other people, she fantasized him as an Ayn Rand hero. I believe she loved the real man. As for what happened with his career, I think, as I indicate in The Passion of Ayn Rand, she was a very powerful and very dominating woman. He did not have the strength to withstand her, and his life began to revolve around her. With certain exceptions, it did so for the rest of their lives.
We're back in the 1930s, and Ayn Rand has written her first novel, We the Living. Tell me about that book. How did that begin, and what was that about?
We the Living is a novel that in many ways is autobiographical, and that it takes place at the time of and after the Soviet Revolution, and it's not in detail autobiographical. It's very highly anti-communist, very strongly anti-communist, and is the story of a young woman attempting to survive and have a career after the Russian Revolution. I think it's a very beautiful book, much more openly emotional than her later work. She wrote it, one of the reasons she wrote it was to get rid of Soviet Russia. In her own mind, in her own psychology, she felt, I don't think she ever would have said she was damaged by it, but it was a very living pain. And after writing the book, she felt it was out of her system. The book, as you may know, was a publishing disaster. This was the 1930s, the so-called Red Decade. It was not a time to publish a book denouncing Soviet Russia, and it failed very badly. In later years, it was reissued, and very successfully, and it still sells. But disaster at the time. I think she made approximately $200 in total on that book at the time.
Through the 30s, her next book was Anthem, and she also wrote a play. Mm-hmm. This play, The Night of January 16th, had a rather controversial beginning and end, and in some mm-hmm. respects, Ayn Rand repudiated the play after other people worked on it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Huh. Well, the play, The Night of January 16th, had a fascinating, what she loved to call, gimmick. She liked the, and she, I think it's what she most enjoyed about her own play. It was the, it's a play about a trial. And the jury for the trial is chosen each night from the audience. And they actually decide the guilt or innocence of the accused. And there are two possible endings to the play determined by the way the jury votes. The play was taken by Al Woods. He was very enthusiastic about it. To her horror and outrage, he decided a good deal of rewriting had to be done, that she had to put in things which everything in her revolted against. The play was successful on Broadway and has been running in summer stock ever since, literally to this day. But she was so unhappy with the changes. She felt it was no longer her play. The success certainly mattered to her financially. It was a means to write. And that's what money was to Ayn, always, a means to write. But apart from that, its success meant nothing to her.
It also had a different title than the one that she gave it.
Yes, its original title was Penthouse Legend. But she was asked to change it to The Night of January 16th, which, again, she felt had nothing much to do with her play and wasn't an interesting title.
I saw The Night of January 16th a couple of years ago, and I guess it was an off-Broadway production.
Yes.
I liked the play. It seemed dated, but I liked the play.
Yes.
But I couldn't tell if this had been the revised edition. I think she revised the play somehow, and it was published by World in 1968.
Yes, it was. There are several versions around. So I don't know which one you might have seen.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
But probably the changing of the elements in that play were the best from a commercial standpoint. I would just assume that the producers of the play knew more about staging the play and what an audience would want than Ayn Rand would have at that time.
She was an awfully good dramatist with a real sense of theater. I don't know, obviously. It may have been that some of their changes were improvements. I don't have an opinion.
Well, that play brought her back, brought her to New York City, where she mm-hmm. began work on the Fountainhead.
That's right.
What was in her mind as she began to write that that second major novel of hers? I guess it was a third. I guess I don't know if Anthem. I'll say second major, because
yes,
Anthem was really a novelette.
Novelette, yes. What she wanted to show, she had always, as I said, since childhood, been interested in the battle between collectivism and individualism. And what she wanted to show in The Fountainhead, among other things, but as the basic theme, was that battle not in social reality, but inside a human being, to show what makes an individualist the sort of human being she believed he was, what makes a collectivist of the spirit the sort of human being he is. She wanted to show two absolutely opposite types of man and to show which one is successful, which one fails, which one is moral, which one is not. She also, and this too I indicated in The Passion of Ayn Rand, in Soviet Russia, watching American movies, had fallen in love with New York, and specifically with American skyscrapers. That, to her, as a child in Russia, was the symbol of what she wanted to reach. She wanted to go to New York. She wanted to see skyscrapers. She felt that that was the living reality of what's the achievement possible to human beings. And in Soviet Russia, she decided one day she's going to write about that. She's going to show what that skyscraper means to her. And that was part of her purpose in the Fountainhead. I think very successfully accomplished.
She was able to finance the writing of that book through the success of the night of January 16th.
Only in part. Her money ran out, and she had to do work as a reader for RKO, for other screen companies. She had a very hard time finishing it. There just was no money.
When she finished the book, did she have any difficulty in getting it published?
She did indeed. It was submitted to 13 publishers, all of whom rejected it for various reasons, before it was accepted by a young editor at Bobbs and Merrill. Even he had a great deal of trouble with the head of Bobbs Merrill, who, in effect, who did turn it down. But the young editor, whose name was Archibald Ogden, told the head of the company, if this is not the book for you, I'm not the editor for you. He staked his job on it. And the publisher said, well, okay, but it better be good.
And it was.
And it was,
and he
indeed.
Kept his job.
He did indeed.
Well, the Fountainhead became, I don't know if it was an overnight success, but it built, didn't it? And
yes.
Eventually became a bestseller.
Yes, it had a very unusual history. It seems as if everything about Ayn Rand's life was unusual. At first, it looked like another disaster. It was selling to some extent, but not really well. Then, gradually and quite slowly, it almost went out of print before this happened. Word of mouth began to spread. And that really is what always has sold Ayn's books. Certainly by the time that she wrote Atlas Shrugged years later, there was a good deal of advertising for her book. With The Fountainhead, there was very little, and it wasn't very good. In her mind, very bad. And it was only word of mouth. Most of the reviews were awful, really negative. There were some exceptions, some important exceptions. But essentially, word of mouth made that book known and got people to read it, and then it became a bestseller.
She and Frank O'Connor went back to the West Coast so that she could work on the screenplay.
That's right.
And she did other work as well, in addition to the screenplay for The Fountainhead, didn't she?
Yes, she did. For several years, she worked for Hal Wallace and wrote screenplays for his studios. She wrote love stories. That was love letters, pardon me. It was an adaptation. You Came Along, which was also an adaptation. Some very successful work.
What year did the film come out?
1948.
And, of course, she was delighted over the casting, at least with regard to Gary Cooper.
Yes, that's who she had wanted from the beginning. In her mind, that's what Howard Roark should have looked like. And she liked the general Gary Cooper type because he was so much an American type, which always fascinated her.
She was also delighted that the dialogue was left intact, except, I believe, for one line.
Yes.
And even that infuriated her.
Yes.
It was only one line, but still.
Well, it infuriated her because she wasn't told and knew only when she saw the preview. She was delighted that the dialogue was kept intact, but exhausted, because she had to fight for every line of that dialogue. There were so many people involved, so many people who had a say, and there was not a second during the filming of that movie that she wasn't engaged in battle to save her original screenplay. It was a Hollywood miracle that she did save it. The story is told that she threatened to blow up Warner Brothers if they changed it. She
might
may have done so.
Would put it past her. Well, we're now in the 1950s, so enter Nathaniel Brandon and his young friend from Canada. How did this meeting come about? Tell me about your first meeting with Ayn Rand.
It was a very exciting meeting. Nathaniel Brandon and I had met because of our mutual love for The Fountainhead, and we were both going to UCLA at the time. Nathaniel had written a letter to Ayn asking her certain philosophical questions about The Fountainhead and We the Living. She was intrigued by his questions. She rarely answered mail. She didn't have the time. She was working on Atlas Shrugged. But she did answer this. A correspondence began. Eventually a meeting was arranged. And Nathaniel invited me, with Ayn's agreement, of course, to go with him the second time and meet her. And it was an evening of pure magic. to encounter that intelligence and that charm was, I couldn't believe it. It took me a long time to believe it. Her intelligence had a kind of magic about it that's almost incommunicable. In my biography, I try to communicate it. I'm not sure I succeeded. It was an aesthetic experience to listen to her talk, to hear the precision, the clarity, the logic. Had I wanted to convince a professor of mathematics that 2 and 2 was 5, he might have been in bad trouble.
She wouldn't have done that.
No, she would certainly not have. But had she wanted to, an immensely persuasive intellect. It went like a laser beam to its target. She was very kind to me and to Nathaniel, very generous with her time. And we felt like a new universe had been opened up to us, and saw her whenever she was willing from then on, and it very soon became a very close friendship.
Based on what I've read in The Passion of Ayn Rand, I would assume, however, that you and Nathaniel rarely challenged her views.
That's not quite so. One wouldn't say challenge, but I, for instance, would often... I was studying philosophy at the time at UCLA. I was an undergraduate. I would often bring her problems in Hume, in Kant, in whoever, that I couldn't solve, but would have been partially convinced of a certain of a certain approach. That was fine with her. She would willingly spend hours perhaps changing my mind, perhaps confirming my opinion. She never objected to disagreement if one were what she considered reasonable in one's views and were open to reason. She didn't demand more than that. But if she believed that she had given you a reasonable argument and you didn't accept it, you were in bad trouble.
This happened time and time again, as you show. That's why she apparently lost almost all of her major friends.
Yes,
and
she did.
Found herself with acolytes,
yes,
around her, young people who were dominated by her,
yes,
intelligence and her presence.
Yes.
So I'm not sure that any rational argument refuting Ayn Rand would have satisfied her. If she had made up her mind, I'm almost certain. Well, I never knew the Ayn Rand,
yes,
but just from what I've read, I would assume she would say, well, look, you're just wrong, and that's it, and leave.
She would never say, you're right in one sense, but she would never say, you're just wrong, and leave. She would have given what to her was an absolutely convincing argument. If she truly believed that she had given, for that particular mind and that particular state of knowledge, all the evidence necessary to rationally convince, then it was never darken my door again. But she wouldn't simply make an assertion, and if you didn't agree, out. There was a chain of arguments, but you had better accept that chain of arguments. And yes, she did end up. This was not really so in the early years that I knew her. But as the years went by, she more and more seemed to require that unanimous agreement among the people around her who were predominantly much younger than she. And if they disagreed, or if they behaved, as was more often the case, in a way she thought wrong, then it was a complete rupture.
Well, Nathaniel and yourself went off to New York University to study, and before long, Ayn Rand and Frank O'Connor also came east. And I guess she worked on Atlas Shrugged the hardest during her New York days.
Yes.
Tell me about this book and how she, why she decided to write it and how this came about.
It really came about when Ayn was 18 years old, or perhaps 17. In Russia, she had the idea, in much more primitive terms, about a book which she had actually sketched out in Russia. Unfortunately, she did not keep her notes on it. But she told me about it at great length. It was to be a book about the mind on strike, about what happens to the world when the most productive intelligences refuse to work any longer, refuse to be bound by the morality of altruism, refuse to accept guilt for their achievements and the money they make as a result of those achievements. That theme of the mind on strike, which is the theme of Atlas Shrugged, came to her when she was 18 years old. And then later in America, She decided that was the book she wanted to do in infinitely more sophisticated form. Reason to her was the great issue in the world. Reason versus faith. That was the issue she believed was at the root of the political social controversies that were tearing the world apart. And she wanted to defend reason and wanted to show what happens, that she felt that reason has been attacked, that the men who use reason, the productive men, the achievers have been attacked. What would happen to the world if they said, okay, we're not going to work for you any longer? And in Atlas, she shows the disintegration of the world without those men whom it has in so many ways despised, the businessmen, the industrialists, the entrepreneurs.
It's a giant book that was published by Random House, and I would assume that Random House made very little attempt to make any changes.
They asked.
Lots of luck.
Right. If a word was changed, I would be surprised. Perhaps something, although even grammatical, would be unlikely. No, there was no editing done on it at all.
The book came out to scathing reviews, including a very bad review in the National Review.
Yes.
But still, that didn't seem to hurt the sale of the book, did it?
No, I think because of the success of The Fountainhead, I don't think anything could have halted the sale of the book. I've met people over the years who have told me, and I think this was quite typical, I read a dreadful review of Atlas Shrugged. I hadn't known it was out before then, so I rushed from my office to the nearest bookstore. They didn't care about the content of the reviews. They simply cared that there was a new book by Ayn Rand.
By this time, Ayn Rand's philosophy seemed to have been pretty well put together. Obviously, isn't the speech in the book something like 64 pages?
Yes,
something
yes
like that,
it is.
Which is a synopsis of her philosophy, but
yes.
It began to develop as an end in itself, and not just something for use in her books, but as a definitive philosophy, a lot of it based on Aristotle. And I would assume that Nathaniel Brandon and yourself helped to formulate this philosophy of objectivism.
No, we did not help to formulate it. We helped to spread it.
Mm-hmm.
The formulation was Ayn's. It was not that things were never added to it. I don't mean that. But its essence, and much more than its essence, most of its details were strictly the work of Ayn Rand. There was no one else's contribution that was of the least significance, because it was fully formed in her mind, and because she wasn't much interested in help of that kind. She knew what she thought.
Well, Nathaniel Brandon began the Nathaniel Brandon Institute.
Yes.
And this was aimed at explaining the philosophy of objectivism. What was Ayn Rand's role in NBI?
Well, it was a small role. At first, she was a little afraid for us when we began organizing classes on her ideas, afraid that it might hurt other possible chances for us, hurt our careers. And she really resisted the idea. She wasn't at all sure we should do it. But when it began to be successful, then she was pleased. Her only role in it was to help us, if necessary, with the content of our courses. And often she would come to question periods, which delighted our students, and they had an opportunity to ask her questions.
Now, along about this period, and you go into great detail about this in The Passion of Ayn Rand, an unusual relationship developed with your reluctant consent and the reluctant consent of Frank O'Connor.
Yes.
This relationship was between Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon, your husband.
Yes.
Tell me, what happened?
What happened was, and this was even before the formation of Nathaniel Brandon Institute, Ayn fell in love with Nathan and wanted to have a love affair with him. As Nathaniel felt at the time, believed at the time, he was in love with her and also wanted to have a love affair. Ayn was not about to tell lies, was not about to pretend. I must say, as I look back on it now, I think it would have been infinitely kinder had Frank and I been lied to. But Ayn considered Ian did what she believed was the reasonable thing to do, which was the four of us sat down and discussed it. And Frank and I walked away from those discussions agreeing. For a lot of reasons. For me, the major reason was my enormous admiration and love for Ian. In my own head, I had idealized Nathaniel as well. And it seemed to me that two such people would inevitably care for each other, would inevitably feel what they appeared to feel. It was terribly painful to me. There were many assurances that Nathaniel and Ian's relationship would do damage to neither marriage. I don't know how I bought that. I don't know how Frank did, but we did. And we finally agreed.
Well, obviously it wasn't going to work, but nobody among the principals involved knew that at the time. In fact, Nathaniel's relationship with her and with you began to drift, and he developed an affair with another woman, a student at NBI.
Yes.
And this led to a rupture between him and Ayn Rand. Tell me, how did this develop?
It wasn't initially the existence of the young woman with whom Nathaniel was deeply in love. Our marriage had long ago disintegrated, and we were separated. It was Ian's desire to continue her love affair with Nathan when Nathan no longer wished to. She didn't know about the existence of the young woman for a long time. She should have known, but she wasn't told. And the rupture really came because Nathaniel no longer wished to continue the affair. And that blew our whole lecture organization and in many ways our whole lives sky high.
It did. It did irreparable damage to objectivism as a organized philosophy. I don't hate to use the term organized philosophy. I guess you shouldn't use that as a phrase. Well, but as a, I think it hurt objectivism. I think people began to see that here is a philosophy that is telling people that we can be perfect. We can be rational human beings, but the people in charge of spreading this philosophy are just as vulnerable as the rest of us.
But you know, you're right. But I think that was a very good lesson for people to learn. I wish it hadn't been so painful. I think it was time they learned it. It was in many ways, in most ways, Ian's desire that she be viewed as a goddess. And I and the other people around her certainly presented her to the world as something like a goddess. It wasn't fair to anybody. She was a human being. She had great virtues, and when she made mistakes, they were big ones. I think she had a right to. I think we all have a right not to be perfect. I think the demand for perfection is unreasonable. We're a certain kind of entity, and the sort of perfection that she demanded was not possible to her. I don't believe is possible to anyone else and should not be demanded. I think many, many of what she considered to be human virtues, I consider to be human virtues. But when she presented her concept of the ideal of the man of pure reason, she really, in many respects, was portraying a man without flaws, which I don't believe is possible, without emotional conflict, which does not seem to be possible. It was a standard not possible to human beings in certain respects.
Well, sides were taken.
Yes, indeed.
You and Brandon went your separate ways, but on the West Coast, Ayn Rand stayed in New York, developed new friends, lost old friends. Mm-hmm. Things were different. This period in her life, was it difficult for her?
Yes, it was very difficult for her. She didn't really lose many friends. She lost Nathaniel and me, but most of the young people who were her friends took her side. Very few took Nathaniel's side or mine. But it was a very unhappy period for her, a very confused period for her. It was necessary for Ian to understand anything that happened to her fully. She felt totally betrayed by Nathaniel and could not understand it. And it was very confusing, very upsetting. She was bitter, angry, hurt. She was unable to make sense of it, and that for Ayn Rand particularly was agony. And there was a great loss of a man she had loved, and now hated.
What about your life after this rupture? How did this change?
I moved to Los Angeles and spent about 2 years convalescing from the past 19, trying to make sense of what had happened to me and what I had done during those years. It was a very difficult period. And what I found in the process was old ambitions, old parts of myself that I had suppressed during those years. It was ultimately a very happy experience for me, the 2 years of convalescence. And it made me able to know finally what I had gained from the years with Ayn Rand and what I had lost, that there were gains and losses.
Now, many years previously, you had taped a series of interviews with Ayn Rand, which served as the basis for The Passion of Ayn Rand. But you also talked to many, many people in order to put this book together. Tell me a little bit about the research and how you got this book organized.
The research was wonderful. I spent almost 2.5 years at it and now feel that I should open a private detective agency, because it consisted in such large part of finding people, and it was wonderful to find the ones I wanted, to find her sister in Leningrad, to find a cousin in Chicago when I knew only her first name, to find another branch of the family in Chicago whom I hadn't known existed at all. I found relatives of Frank's, a movie actress who knew Ian in 1926 when Ian lived in Hollywood, people who knew Frank when he was a young boy. It was a wonderful, exciting experience. And I was able to talk to the ones still alive, I believe all the people who were important in her life. One way or another, I was able to talk to them.
But not Nathaniel Brandon.
Yes, I did interview
him. You did?
Oh, yes, I did.
I didn't see too many direct quotes from him.
Well, I
you may have had to have done that.
I guess it wasn't necessary. I do have interviews with him.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Leonard
Peikoff? No, no. I did not interview Leonard.
He is your cousin and, Ayn Rand's heir. And I understand that you and Leonard Peikoff have been estranged for many years, apparently over this initial rupture.
Yes. I don't know what's in his head, obviously. All I can tell you is that after my break with Ayn Rand, he has refused any contact. I haven't solicited it, but he has denounced me and refused to have anything to do with me. Oddly, he has denounced The Passion of Ayn Rand, simultaneously saying he hasn't read it and doesn't intend to, but he's on record for denouncing it.
Well, it's interesting to note that there was an effort for you and Ayn Rand to heal the wounds, and apparently this may have been able to develop had she not become extremely ill and eventually died. You did have one meeting.
Yes, I did, in a very lovely meeting. I can't say I know what would have come of it, but I had not seen her or spoken to her in a number of years. And one day, I thought how nice it would be to speak to her and see how she is. And in Los Angeles, I picked up the phone, called her in New York. I didn't know whether she'd slam the phone on me or not. But in the late 60s, I'd become rather adjusted to people slamming phones on me as a result of breaking with Ian. She didn't. She was very welcoming, very warm. And when I was in New York, I spent a day with her, which was, in many ways, an enchanted day.
I'm glad she was in a good mood that day.
Yes. And that it was in a good mood towards me, who had broken with her, was truly startling.
Well, this is probably an unfair question because you are so close to Ayn Rand, but maybe we can just kind of speculate together. I wonder how history, both literary and philosophic, is going to treat Ayn Rand. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Perhaps I am too close, but I do have thoughts about it. I think, as a novelist, she will live a very, very long time. As a philosopher, my guess would be, part guess, partly educated guess, I would think the problem, one of the serious problems is the total of her philosophy has never been spelled out. She has done some nonfiction work, but not She often used to speak about when she was 80, she would write a treatise on her philosophy, but she didn't get to be 80. I don't know if she would have done it. I think because it isn't spelled out, she will, I believe, remain as a significant minor philosopher, which seems to me appropriate. She had a good deal to contribute, and I don't think it will be forgotten.
And Nathaniel Brandon is not picking up on it.
No, his interest is, as I understand it, psychology, not philosophy.
I understand that Nathaniel Brandon is writing his own version of his affair with Ayn Rand.
I've heard that. I don't have any first-hand knowledge of it.
Well, Barbara Brandon, I appreciate you coming in to synopsize the book. We covered a lot of territory actually longer period of time than I expected, but I thought it was an absolutely fascinating book, and I couldn't put it down.
I read that in
essentially, I started it on Friday, but I finished it Saturday afternoon.
How wonderful.
I just couldn't put it down. I also liked the photographs are interesting, and it just shed more light on a woman I really didn't know very much about.
Nobody does. Yeah. Nobody did. Let's hope with the passion of Ayn Rand they will.
Yes. Barbara Brandon, thank you very much.
Thank you.